Some of the thorniest debates in the history of the United States come down to rights that seem to be directly in conflict with one another. Think fetus versus woman in cases of unwanted pregnancies. When West Germany created its laws on abortion back in the 1970s, it was actually a more divisive issue there than in the United States around the time of Roe v. Wade. But based in large part on the way the Germans structured their law, legislators allowed abortion under certain conditions rather than declaring it a constitutional right, there is very little debate over the procedure there today. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Our discussion today is not actually about abortion, but about the ways the American Pursuit of Rights declarations actually creates divisions by framing rights as a zero-sum game. Jamal Green is here to walk us through this. He is Dwight Professor of Law at Columbia Law School and author of the book How Rights Went Wrong: Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart. Jamal, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So courts in the United States find themselves deciding the interests they consider rights and those that are not rights. How does the declaration of a right limit the ability of lawmakers to adjust public policy around disputed issues?
Well, we've come to think about rights as being basically antagonistic to lawmaking. So a right is an individual's entitlement to pursue their interest, notwithstanding that there's a law on the other side. And so we obviously celebrate that in many contexts when rights are very important to protect. But every time a right is declared, at least if the right is something close to absolute or presumptively absolute, it means that someone is getting to do something notwithstanding that society has determined that that's not something that they should necessarily do. So lots and lots of rights, you know, even if we think some rights are great, and I certainly think that, lots and lots of rights can be corrosive of communities and community decision making and democracy. So we've got to try to figure out a way of balancing.
Well, we have rights to some things that we consider essential, like free speech and voting, but not to others like housing and healthcare. On what grounds do we decide what rises to the level of right in this country?
Well, I think you've pointed to a problem, which is that there are lots and lots of things that members of a pluralistic society are going to think are important. You mentioned a few: free speech, equality, healthcare, education, food. Some people might think it's really important that they be able to walk around without a mask, right? This is recent. So how do you choose between those things if you have to? Well, within our legal culture, when we're talking about constitutional rights, we try to look to the Constitution. But the problem is the Constitution doesn't really specify any of those rights, not in so many words. Our Constitution is quite vague. It's very short. It's actually the second shortest constitution in the world after the Constitution of Monaco, right? So we have a constitution that basically says there's a general equality right, there are some due process rights, there is a free speech right, but actually according to its text, it only applies to Congress, for example. So you've got to interpret these things in order to get them to apply to lots and lots of modern conflicts, whether it's over free speech or affirmative action or abortion rights or campaign finance or what have you, or even gun rights. So how do you balance it if the legislature is trying to pursue a right to public health and someone on the other side is saying, well, no, I have a right to not get vaccinated or something? So there are any number of ways in which these things can conflict. And we tend to resort to kind of legalistic interpretive moves. How do we understand the text? How do we understand this old precedent? How do we understand what the founders intended? Rather than thinking about conflicts of rights, which are everywhere, in terms of their particular facts. What is the government trying to accomplish? How ham-handed is the government in trying to accomplish it? How costly is it to individuals? So we tend to think of them of rights in legalistic terms rather than in the ordinary ways that someone talks about whether someone is being treated fairly or not.
So help me understand this, because you note early Americans were big believers in rights, but they didn't necessarily think the courts or even the Constitution would be best suited to provide them, especially given the reality, as you've noted, that two apparent rights might be in conflict with one another. How did the founders think these competing rights might be managed?
Well, the founders were very big on rights, right? So, and we all know this, you know, there's a Bill of Rights, there's the Declaration of Independence, which of course talks about the unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But of course, those can't be absolute for everyone because they come into conflict with each other. And what the founders understood, and what I think is really important to recover in the founders' example, is that when rights come into conflict, the way in which you resolve those conflicts and the way in which you figure out reasonable limits on rights is through government, is through self-government. And the very next line in the Declaration of Independence, after the line about unalienable rights and life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, is about the reason why governments are instituted. Governments are instituted in order to protect our rights, right? So this idea of this antagonism between rights and government was very much contrary to the framers' ideal. The framers' ideal was you set up local legislatures, you set up juries. The jury system was very important to them in protecting rights and in determining how far rights go. It wasn't about, you know, federal judges coming along and declaring someone's individual rights against the community. The Bill of Rights was, if you look at it more carefully, as I do in the first chapter of the book, is primarily about establishing institutions of local self-government. Now, that's what's worth recovering, because you figure out the limits of rights through the kinds of political interactions you have in a legislature, in a jury, in a church, for example, all of which are protected institutions under the Bill of Rights. But those communities at the time were, of course, exclusive, right? So they're communities of propertied white men. So there's an obvious problem at the founding where rights are going to be consistent with self-government, but that self-government is exclusive and limited and white supremacist. So a lot of the rest of American history has been trying to figure out, how do we integrate genuine pluralism, where we actually are going to care about a wide range of people who have a wide range of values and commitments? How do we integrate the rights of those people into some idea of self-government? We're still trying to sort this out. One really bad way of doing that is to have a court try to decide whose rights count and whose rights don't count, because that's going to end up circumscribing which rights are available and which ones are not. It's alienating, it's polarizing, and it doesn't recognize that we're all very different from one another.
Okay, let's talk about how two sets of rights came to be seen as possibly mutually exclusive so that only one could exist. What was at issue in Lochner versus New York?
So Lochner versus New York is a case that's really well known to lawyers, but maybe a little bit less well known outside of the legal profession.
This is a case. I can confirm that, yes.
Yeah, so this is a 1905 case out of New York, where New York wants to pass a law that limits the number of hours bakers can work in bakeries to 60 hours a week or 10 hours a day. So this is a health and safety measure. They say that bakers are more likely to get tuberculosis and other diseases, and their hours should be limited. And it's challenged by a bakery owner named Joseph Lochner, and the Supreme Court strikes it down in a closely divided opinion. Strike down the New York law because it says it violates the bakers and the bakery owners' rights of contract. They should have the right to contract over their hours and wages and other things without interference from the legislature. That's what the court says. Now, Lochner is understood to be the Lochner case is understood to be kind of a pariah among American lawyers because that kind of thinking, right, the idea that individuals can block ordinary social welfare and labor legislation by declaring something called a right to contract, which is not explicitly in the Constitution, would end up frustrating a lot of progressive era labor reform it ends up frustrating in many ways President Roosevelt's response to the Great Depression and the New Deal. And there's this big conflict between kind of laissez-faire courts and progressive, and I'm using progressive in the sense of people who supported, tended to support labor legislation, health and safety measures in the beginning of the 20th century. There's this big conflict, and eventually the court backs down. Roosevelt ends up getting a bunch of his own justices on the court. Court backs down, and Lochner is held up as like the worst thing you can do if you're a judge. Kind of making up rights is the accusation is making up rights, declaring that people can push back on the government when it's just trying to pursue what's called ordinary social and economic legislation. So there's this whole category of rights claims that within the American legal culture are understood to be totally off limits. You just totally defer to the legislature. At the same time, though, this is the middle of the 20th century, you've got a massive system of racial oppression happening in southern states, right? So you can't have a system where you say we defer entirely to the government, and oh, by the way, the governments of the Deep South are denying citizenship entirely to Black Americans, religious discrimination or McCarthyism. And there definitely are situations in which you don't defer to the legislature because the legislature is abusive or oppressive, right? So the American system of rights kind of develops along two tracks, where one track is trying to run as fast as it can away from the Lochner decision and say, look, you defer to legislatures, that's what democracy is all about. And the other track is saying, well, we'll try to pick out those instances like Jim Crow, where you don't defer to the legislature at all. And rights are basically absolute. Right against racial discrimination is as strong a right as we have in the American system. Your right to free speech if someone's trying to arrest you for being a communist, right? That's there's nothing less American than that in our modern consciousness. But this is a problem, right? If the only way we think about rights is either you make a rights claim and it's just not a claim at all, and that's one track, and the other track is you've got a kind of absolute right. That's not a very nuanced way to think about rights, and it leads to all kinds of problems once we get into, well, not Jim Crow, but an abortion restriction or a birth control law, not McCarthyism, but someone who wants to burn their draft card, right? Not Lochner versus New York and a bakery law, but someone who is being denied welfare benefits and thinks that they actually deserve them, right? Most of the ways in which we claim rights are somewhere between the extreme of you should defer entirely to the legislature, there's no right at all, and the other extreme, which is you protect the right absolutely, and we still don't really have a language in which we can talk comfortably about that large middle ground.
Okay, Jamal, who was Felix Frankfurter, and what role did he play in the dominance of the Oliver Wendell Holmes view of rights?
So Felix Frankfurter is a really interesting character. His name will be well known to constitutional types. He sat on the Supreme Court from the end of the 1930s until the early 1960s. So he's famous in that sense. But his import it actually goes beyond being on the Supreme Court, and actually comes, I think, earlier than his time on the court. So he's this really kind of almost sage of the American progressives in the early 1930s. He's a very well-known Harvard law professor. He becomes friends with Franklin Roosevelt and ends up sort of picking a huge number of administrators who are going to populate the Roosevelt administration in the 1930s. And then he has this whole network of clerks and people who he places in clerkships with famous judges like Oliver Wendell Holmes and Louis Brandeis and Learned Hand. And so he's this kind of really kind of energetic, charismatic figure at the center of American law, and especially for progressives in the 1930s in particular. But the other thing about him was that he really worshipped Oliver Wendell Holmes and worshipped in a way that's that almost feels unhealthy, right? He at every opportunity, he's sort of praising Holmes as being this amazing jurist, and he especially praises Holmes's dissenting opinion in the Lochner case. And so Frankfurter acts as this kind of entrepreneur who trains people and then has these people be sort of worship and be indebted to him, that the sine qua non of American rights doctrine is Holmes's dissent in the Lochner case, which recall is this opinion that says, you know, you defer entirely to the legislature. Now, Frankfurter well understood, and he's, you know, he knew Holmes very well, but he comes a bit later in history. He well understood that you can't be entirely deferential. You know, he sits on the court that decides Brown versus Board of Education, outlawing racial segregation in American public schools in 1954. So he understands that you can't be totally deferential, but he is really more powerfully than I think just about anyone in American history emphasizes this idea that the way in which that democracy is really important, and you defer to legislatures unless there's something sort of really pathological happening that judges are really able to do something about, and school segregation would be an example of that. So Frankfurter just really runs with Holmes, and we're still living in Frankfurter's world, right? So Frankfurter dies just before the 1960s, but the world that starts, or in the early 1960s, I should say, the world that really rises up in the 1960s is a world in which people are claiming rights sort of everywhere you turn. And it's not just racial segregation, it's not just McCarthyism, but it's also not, you know, people claiming rights to contract and trying to overcome labor legislation. It's a million different things at once. And Frankfurter's frame and what we kind of inherit from him is still a frame of, well, we got to figure out which things are rights and which things are not. And the things that are rights, we're going to really protect very strongly. And the things that are not, we're not going to protect at all. And so if that's the case, then the stakes of having your interest declared to be a right by a court become really, really high. And so the way in which we end up structuring our politics is to try to shoehorn our political interests into rights terms that can then be decided by courts. And that's just very unhealthy.
And so today, U.S. courts are inclined to view rights as a zero-sum game. What sort of power does that give them as the arbiters of who holds rights in cases where they're disputed?
Well, I don't want to oversimplify things, because okay. I'm not suggesting that you were either, Chris. I do think that there are instances where courts end up at the end of the day recognizing that they can't entirely view rights as zero-sum games, but they don't really have a language in which to talk about that. I think courts in the U.S. are extremely anxious about their power. They recognize that they don't have the democratic credentials of a legislature, but they are socialized into believing that part of their job is to declare our rights, which is, of course, something that is very momentous. So what the instinct tends to be is to look at a rights conflict and then try to think about that rights conflict in a way that justifies judicial power. So what would that look like? Well, judges are good at figuring out what the founders intended. They're good at reading texts. They're good at figuring out the meaning of words, right? They're good at looking at precedents. These sound like the things that well-trained lawyers and judges are supposed to be good at. And so they have the power to declare which rights we have and which rights we don't. But the way in which they exercise that power is in a very abstract, legalistic way. So that's, I think, the self-conception of judges is as having less power because they are constrained They understand themselves to be constrained by the legal materials that they rely on. They're not just trying to figure out what's fair or what's just, or relying on their own notions of morality or something like that. They're looking at original intentions, and they're looking at text, and they're looking at precedent. That seems very legalistic. But that's still that still gives them a tremendous amount of power. The power comes from the role they play in declaring one right over another, rather than and understanding their job in those terms, rather than understanding those jobs in a much more retail sort of way, working out much more contextual, factual differences between the parties.
Okay, so how has the court's modern view of rights shaped their ability to deal with laws that have, say, discriminatory racial impact?
So this is an area, racial discrimination, and particularly as you frame it, Chris, racially discriminatory impact, where courts have been kind of paralyzed by this binary way in which they think about rights. So what do we mean by racially discriminatory impact? A law is passed, and I'll just use it as an example, like a case from the late 1970s, where Massachusetts has a preference in its civil service jobs for people who are veterans of the US military. It turns out that women have faced discrimination over decades up to that point. And so there are many, many fewer female veterans than male veterans. And so a woman sues and says, I actually should have gotten this civil service job, but I didn't get the job because I was not a military veteran. And this particular policy has a discriminatory impact on women. So how should a court approach that kind of situation? Well, the way the Supreme Court approaches this in a case called Feeney from 1978 is it says, well, we have to decide whether this counts as discrimination. And the only way it can count as discrimination is if it was intentional. And by intentional, what we mean is the reason why we put in this veterans preference was because we were out to get, we wanted to make sure women didn't get these jobs. And if that wasn't the case, if it wasn't that kind of invidious intentional discrimination, then it's not a constitutional claim at all. Now, why would you have that kind of frame for this kind of case? Why would you say the only way you can bring in a discrimination claim is if it's intentional? Well, the court there was relying on an earlier case where it says, you know, if we ever made it possible to bring a constitutional claim just based on what's called disparate impact of a law, not intentional discrimination, but a strong discriminatory impact, well, that would make every law something that might get struck down. Or because of past discrimination, everything has a disparate impact on the basis of race. And most things have a disparate impact on the basis of sex as well, right? So we can't have every law be struck down. And so therefore we have to put this limitation on the right against discrimination. It's gotta be intentional. This is a very good example of the way in which this frame leads courts to separate what rights we have from what's just, right? So the court limits what counts as a right because it doesn't have any language or any capacity, it doesn't think it has any capacity to make more nuanced distinctions between different kinds of laws. Right? So it thinks you have to strike down everything. If a disparate impact is enough to make something a constitutional problem, you've got to go strike down everything. This is part of the problem, right? How would an ordinary person approach this kind of case, right? If you're not looking at it in this binary frame, right? You'd say, well, why did they put this preference in place? How big is the impact on women? Is there a way of honoring military veterans in some way that doesn't have the same degree of impact? You know, you would ask questions that actually point to the justice of this situation, rather than saying, well, what is the nature of the right what's the nature of the right against discrimination? This kind of philosophical question. when this is not a philosophical issue, it's a dispute between a citizen and their government, where the government is pursuing a policy. That policy has a bad impact. It's a democratically enacted law, right? So that deserves some weight, right? But it also has this awful impact on women. So let's try to figure out and exercise our judgment about whether this policy is justified or not, rather than just sort of say, well, either it's got to be intentional or the women have to go home.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There are examples of how other countries have faced similar challenges to laws that had uneven impact on different groups of people. Tell us about how South Africa coped with challenges to a post-apartheid law that a white resident of Pretoria claimed discriminated against white South Africans in the immediate aftermath of apartheid.
So this case, the South African case, and the book does refer to a number of cases from other places, in part because I want to show how unusual Americans are, in fact, in the way we tend to think about rights. And this South African case is a good one to think about in the context of this Massachusetts civil service case, because there it's a, in some technical way, it's a disparate impact case. So this is post-apartheid South Africa. It's the city of Pretoria. And the question has to do with the utility rates that that are being charged to residents of old Pretoria, which used to be entirely white by law, and the outlying townships, which are essentially entirely black. A practice had developed of charging different rates, utility rates, for the outlying townships because they didn't have meters. And so the infrastructure was much weaker. And so they just charged a flat rate, and the flat rate was lower than the rates charged in the all-white center of town. And a practice developed of no one ever paying in the township, no one ever paying these rates either. And they didn't really try to collect them either because nobody had any money, right? So this is the system in place when apartheid ends. Almost the day after apartheid ends, they keep this system in place because on the ground, in fact, it's the same situation. There's still no infrastructure. There's still people in the township still have no money. But a white resident of old Pretoria sues and says, you're discriminating against me on the basis of my race because you're charging me a higher utility rate than people in the outlying townships. Now, this is a very kind of cynical claim to bring right after the end of apartheid, right? Because, of course, this person has had lots of advantages. And if this had happened in the U.S., it actually, he would have lost very quickly. And he would have lost very quickly because this is disparate impact. Because, the reason the different utility rates are being charged is not in order to disadvantage white residents of Pretoria. It's for an entirely different reason. But the South African court, even in this really cynical situation, approaches the case very differently and says, yes, this is not intentional discrimination against white people in Pretoria, but this is racial discrimination. Because the fact of the matter is, as anyone knows from our history, charging a different amount for people in the old city versus the township is going to have a massive disparate racial effect. We can't blind ourselves, the court says, to the reality of the situation. And so the real question, and here's the key. The real question is not, is there discrimination going on? A question that U.S. courts would have answered no to. South African court says, of course there's discrimination going on. The real question is this unfair discrimination? And answering that question requires us to dive pretty deeply into the context here. When was this policy put in place? Why was it put in place? Why was it maintained? Who's burdened by it? What other kinds of burdens do these people face? So if it's an historically disadvantaged group, we might look differently upon burdens imposed on that group than on others. And it puts all these contextual factors together and concludes that, well, no, in this context, it's not unfair discrimination. Now, he actually ends up winning a little bit because it turns out that what they do say is there's no reason to not collect back payments from people in the townships, but to collect it from the people in the old city. But the different rates being charged is this is discrimination, but it's but in the light of the history and the broader context, it's not unfair. Now this is hard work to do, and this involves judges sometimes second guessing decisions made by legislatures. It involves close questions. It involves judgment calls, but it gets at the kind of constitutional justice that rights are put into a constitution to effectuate, because it's not just an abstract question of is this discrimination. It's a question of fairness.
How has the all or nothing U.S. approach to rights fueled so much partisan rancor over time?
So I think this is a complex story. But the simple version of it is that if I think that a dispute, but that's basically a political dispute that I have with my neighbor, should be understood as a rights dispute, and that that rights dispute is going to be decided by a court, and that court is going to decide which of us has the right and which of us doesn't have the right. Well, that's converted political conversation into a conversation about who the Constitution favors and who the Constitution doesn't favor. That is a very high stakes frame for the conversation. And I'll give an example of this. There's a case called Masterpiece Cake Shop. This is a case that some listeners may have some recollection of. It from a few years ago, this baker in Colorado refuses to bake a wedding cake for same-sex couples. He says that it violates his religious freedom and violates his freedom of speech because he understands himself to be basically an artist when it comes to cakes. And so that's why he calls his shop Masterpiece Cake Shop. And there's a Colorado law that says you can't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. You've got to treat gay and lesbian customers the same as others. And so Colorado Civil Rights Commission, so this couple comes in, they want a wedding cake for their wedding. They don't say that there's any particular thing they want on their cake. They just wanted a nice cake for their wedding. And he refuses. And the couple brings a complaint against him before the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. It ends up going to the Supreme Court. And the way that this case gets argued about, both in court and at oral argument before the Supreme Court and in the media coverage around the case, is sort of on one side, there's religious freedom and freedom of speech. And on the other side, there is equality. And, you know, you've got to decide, the court's got to decide which we care about more. Do we care more about equality or do we care more about freedom of religion and freedom of speech? And predictably, people line up along their partisan lines, and people who are on the left tend to line up on the equality side, and people on the right tend to line up on the religious freedom and freedom of speech side. And so this dispute over a cake sort of puts us into our corners. And you read the briefs in the court, and you've got one side, you got the people who are favoring the couple saying this is just the same thing as putting up a whites only sign in your window, like from the Jim Crow South. And the other side is saying this is the height of intolerance. You know, what if a customer comes in and says, I want a Ku Klux Klan cake or I want a Nazi cake? Would he really have to bake that cake for them? So you've got people, you know, one side is saying you're just like the segregationists and the other side is saying you're just like the Nazis. Nothing could be more polarizing than that frame for a political dispute. But it turns out that if you read very, very carefully, and much more carefully than I think either the court itself or people in the covering the case or hearing about the case read, they actually agreed on a whole lot of things. You know, the couple actually agreed that he doesn't have to serve people whose ideological interests he opposes. And the baker agreed that he actually can't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. What they disagreed about is whether baking a cake for this wedding counted as discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, or whether it counted as disagreement on ideological grounds. Right, that's a hard question. And I don't think it's an obvious, it has an obvious answer. But once we narrow the dispute to really just a dispute about that question, is what kind of discrimination is this? Well, then we can ask another, you know, we can start to try to solve the problem rather than trying to line up on one side or the other. So how might you solve this kind of problem? Well, if the baker's objection is to having his particular cake used in a wedding, maybe he can use a sous chef to design the cake. What would he say to that? What would the couple say to that? I don't know, right? Because it never comes up because we're too busy arguing about Nazis and Klansmen rather than arguing about this particular case and this particular set of facts. A much less polarizing frame than the way we tend to frame these things. So just to go back to this question of polarization, is this kind of Manichaean on-off switch to who has the right and who's right encourages us to get into our respective corners, as opposed to encouraging us to get into the politics of trying to figure out how to resolve our problems, which is what we really need.
Do you think this zero-sum game approach to court-granted rights has had the effect of driving more partisan nominations to the Supreme Court?
I think it has. There are a small number of particular issues that I think tend to drive the nominations, and of course, abortion rights is a big part of that. I do think that there are ways in which the dispute over abortion rights has been an example of this kind of binary way we think about rights and the idea that we have to line up on one side. Either you're pro-choice or you're pro-life, right? But, you know, which are you? You've got to make a choice, as opposed to trying to figure out what common ground there might be between those things. So that if a court's going to decide which side is right, the pro-life, so who does the Constitution support? Does the Constitution support the pro-life side or the pro-choice side? Well, then of course there's going to be a massive political fight over who gets to be on that court, because that's a very high stakes. Becomes a very high stakes question. So I do think that thinking about rights in a different way could potentially lower the temperature of these court battles, because it takes away from the court the notion that it is defining sort of who's right in the great American divide for all time. Going back to the bake shop example, just to put some texture into the example, you know, if the court has to decide the question of, well, does he really have to be the one to bake the cake, or can his sous chef bake it? Well, then in the next case, you know, there'll be different facts, and maybe it comes out slightly differently because the facts are different. Whereas if the court has to decide, you know, does the Constitution care more about the equality rights of gay and lesbian citizens, or about free speech rights and religious discrimination? Well, that's a very high temperature dispute, and it doesn't give a lot of space for someone to stay invested in the project of constitutional law if they lose, right? Someone's just told you don't count. So yes, I do think that we could potentially lower some of the temperature and try to get some of our disputes over rights back into ordinary politics.
How has our approach to rights complicated the application of affirmative action policies?
So this is an issue where, like so many of the other issues, the way that the legal culture has approached it is to try to figure out who has the right. You've got an applicant to a school who is claiming that their chances of getting in to the school are diminished because the school takes race into consideration, usually to the benefit of African-American and Hispanic applicants to the school. The way that, you know, if you look at rights in a very narrow sort of way as a kind of absolute right, And when we talk about racial discrimination, well, that's the most absolute right of all, right? So the way that these cases are framed is someone is claiming that a public institution, a public school, is discriminating on the basis of race. And so the instances in which they're going to be allowed to do that are going to be very, very, very narrow. What's happened with the court's cases in this area is the reason why many institutions discriminate on the basis of race in affirmative action plans, right, is because they're trying to vindicate the equality rights of those people affected, right? So the minority applicants are on the view of the schools would be treated unfairly if they were not to take race into consideration, because different groups are not similarly situated. So it's very much more complicated than racial discrimination of the Jim Crow South, for example. But the way the courts frame frames the controversy makes an affirmative action case look the same as Jim Crow. Now, of course, everyone knows that it's not the same. Right? Everyone knows it's not the same to have an affirmative action plan as it is to segregate your schools, right? That's obviously the government is being motivated differently. And so courts end up giving some space for schools to have affirmative action plans if they frame their interests in terms of diversity, in their interest in diversity, and we hear that term all the time, rather than their interest in equalizing the playing field for minority applicants, right? So instead of saying, yeah, there are rights on both sides of this question, and we've got to, you know, maybe we've got to figure out if this particular admissions plan is actually unfair or not, in the way that the South African court had to figure out whether its metering policy was actually unfair or not. Instead of doing that, because we can't have two rights in the case at the same time, because rights are kind of absolute, the court forces schools to change the language in which they talk about this issue. But once they change the language in which they talk about this issue, then it looks like they're not being entirely transparent or entirely fair-minded. So you end up with lots of distortion. You end up with lots of sort of misleading claims. You end up with lots of suspicion because what schools say they're doing looks a little bit different from what their policies actually are. And all because, or not all because, but largely because schools have been disabled from being transparent about the fact that affirmative action policies involve an effort to vindicate someone's rights. The idea that there are rights in the case on both sides is something courts have trouble dealing with.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there some prohibition, either explicit or implied, in the Constitution against the government recognizing race and the differing impacts it might have on the way the same law affects different groups of people?
So there's lots of reason to be suspicious when the government invokes race. Given our history, obviously race has been used in highly pernicious ways, but there's no general, in the text of the Constitution, there's no general prohibition on governments using race in various ways. The text that we tend to rely on in race cases is the Equal Protection Clause, which is part of the 14th Amendment, which is passed right after the Civil War in order to help integrate emancipated slaves back into civil society, among other things. But that was the main reason why the 14th Amendment is enacted. There is some racial sensitivity and sensitivity to government use of race built into the history of the 14th Amendment. But the 14th Amendment doesn't say the government can't use race. And in fact, in the early history of the 14th Amendment, the government did use race. The federal government used race explicitly in order, and had a form of an affirmative action plan in order to help out people who were formerly emancipated slaves, right? So what the 14th Amendment and what the Constitution requires is that people be treated equally. And equal treatment might sometimes mean, and might often mean, not taking race into consideration at all, but under conditions of structural inequality, where we have massive and persistent differences in the socioeconomic status, the wealth, public health, criminal justice exposure of people on the basis of race, you know, different racial groups are not similarly situated to each other. So treating them exactly the same is a form of unequal treatment. The only way you can figure out how to treat people equally is to think carefully about the context and think carefully about the situation.
Jamal Green is Dwight Professor of Law at Columbia Law School. His book is called How Rights Went Wrong: Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart. Jamal, thank you very much for making time to spend with us today.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. It's free. You just have to search for KERA Think or listen at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.